History in a Nation's Eyes, wrote one, and be sworn in on the balcony of Federal Hall at the corner of Wall and Broad. And it was through those streets, the streets of the first capital of the new republic, that there walked the three men, Hamilton, Jay, and Madison, who together were Publius, author of the 85 great essays urging ratification of the controversial new constitution. To many of the reformer aristocrats, the history of those streets was family history. The roles of Citizens' Union and City Club, and of groups such as the American Scenic and Historic Preservation Society, were filled with names like Morris and Bayard and De Peyster and Van Rensselaer and Gerry and Hamilton. But as the age of skyscrapers had made land so valuable that history could no longer find a place on it, they had had to watch as cobbled slips and lanes had been paved over with asphalt, and as row after row of beautiful, sober, red-faced federal residences, of buildings that housed sailmakers' shops and ships' chandleries behind Greek lintels and steeply pitched dormers redolent of the harbor's historic sailing age, had crumbled beneath the wrecker's iron balls. Before their eyes, the elegant townhouses that had stood on State Street in a neat, graceful row had been torn down one by one, even number 9, where Lafayette had lived, until only one remained, the delicate ironwork of its balconies and the slimness of its tall white columns, an ironic grace note in a cityscape without grace. By 1939, Fonce's Tavern was the only structure left associated with the 100 moments of triumphs and glory Washington had played out in those streets. In an area dedicated to commerce, in which men spoke in what Henry James called the vocabulary of thrift, there was no interest in a more epic vocabulary. Once Lower Manhattan had been steeped in history. Now that sense of history was gone, vanished, crushed out of those streets as completely as the scents of the sea. But turn a corner, and there was history and sunlight and sky, and, stretching before you, the sea. For turn a corner, the corner at the bottom of Pearl or Front Street, for example, or the bend at the foot of Broadway, and there was Battery Park. Step into Battery Park, and suddenly, remarkably suddenly, the city was all behind you. Walk down one of its winding paths, for its paths were winding then, under the leaves of the big old trees that lined them, for they were lined with big old trees then, and the clamor of the traffic-jammed streets of Lower Manhattan faded away so quickly that within 100 paces only an occasional particularly strident car horn remained as a reminder of what you had just escaped. Sit down on one of the benches under the trees, and what you heard first was mostly quiet, as if your ears had become so attuned to the din you had left that for a minute or two they couldn't register more subtle sounds. But then you began to hear the sparrows and the orioles and the harsh, faraway scream of some sea bird. You began to notice the flutter of a waxwing from tree to tree, the soft swoop of gulls across the high sky. If, sitting there, you looked back at the tall buildings behind you, you saw them through leaves, and they didn't look so tall. They seemed, in fact, rather far away. Only a few steps out of the sunless streets, you had found sunlight. Only a few steps out of their colorless walls, you had found green lawns. Only a few steps out of their tumult, you had found peace. And if you got up and walked a little deeper into the park, suddenly, before you, there, through the trees, was the heavy blue-green swell of the sea, and that rhythmic, restless sound, at once peaceful and intense, was the lapping of the waves against the shore, and all at once, only steps from the dead gray walls of Lower Manhattan, you were standing at the edge of a broad and busy harbor. Crisscrossing the waves were stubby tugboats, freighters with derricks and masts, a tall forest on their decks, speedy motorboats skimming from crest to crest, gaily painted ferries, private steam yachts, white-painted and glistening, giant gleaming ocean liners, so big that their sides were moving cliffs. Everywhere there were bright flags, the pennons and burgees of the yachts, the tricolor of the Normandy and the Union Jack of the Queens, the colors of a dozen other foreign nations, and all fluttering against the blue of the sky. It was a panorama of vastness and beauty in the sun, of drama in storms, when the tossing white caps that stretched to the horizon, the howling of the wind that filled your ears, and the smash of the waves against the piers at your feet made you remember with a start that Manhattan was only an island, and that you were standing at its very tip. And at night, with the towering Statue of Liberty enlightening the world, floodlit from pedestal to torch, and the rows of lamps on the ferry boats gliding across the dark waters, the view from the Battery was, as one of the reformers put it, a thing of beauty never to be forgotten. Sunlight, serenity, a sense of the sea, and something more. For walk into Battery Park at its Broadway entrance, and staring at you, at the end of a long, broad, grand allée, was an odd-looking building. If you knew the history of New York City, you could read it in layers on that building. Architects remodeling it to make its appearance harmonize with its present purpose, for the last half-century it had been the City Aquarium, had given it a three-story high facade that made it look like a toy fort, with rounded turrets at each end, a cornice crenellated to resemble battlements and flags along the top, and a white stucco finish that, shining in the sun, would have made it a perfect target. In that gay facade, the massive bolt-studded and iron-reinforced doors, set in an immense stone portal 20 feet high, loomed with an inappropriate grimness. But if you knew the history of New York, you knew why those doors were there, and you knew that if you stripped that layer of stucco away from the lower story, you would find behind it huge, rugged walls of weather-beaten sandstone, walls 20 feet high and 8 feet thick, walls thick enough to withstand the bombardment of a fleet, walls through whose barred embrasures had glinted black 32-pounders capable of sweeping the harbor from shore to shore. You knew that if the top two stories of that odd building were a fake fort, the bottom story, behind the facade, was a real fort. Fort Clinton, constructed during the War of 1812 to repel an expected British invasion. Fort Clinton, named after Erie Canal builder DeWitt, the fort that in 1939 stood in Battery Park under a coat of white stucco and two stories of fish tanks, had never fired a shot in anger. The expected British invasion never came, probably, historians believed, because the British were deterred by the presence of Fort Clinton and its sister fort on Governor's Island, Castle William, and no enemy fleet was ever again to threaten New York. The only ships ever sunk by its 28 32-pounders were hulks sunk for target practice. But the broad circle, a full 200 feet in diameter, of its massive walls was an evocation in weathered red sandstone of the nearly two centuries when men ran for forts at the news of Indians or the French. Walk down beside it, stand beside one of its embrasures, and see where its cannon bore. Then look out across the harbor and see, across a mile of water, the massive hulk, unstuccoed, grim, cannon still mounted, so that through its embrasures the sun still glinted off black metal of its sister fort, and you were back in another, more heroic age. Walk down beside it, and that city behind you, that city without history, had a history again. And in that building there was the history of still another era to read. For behind that stucco facade was also a domed roof that, built in 1824, transformed Fort Clinton, its guns still in place, into Castle Clinton, or Castle Garden, circular auditorium and theater. If Fort Clinton was heroism, Castle Garden was the glory heroism earned. It was at Castle Garden on August 16, 1824, that, in the words of one historian, it was proved that republics are not always ungrateful. For it was at Castle Garden on that date that Gilbert de Motier, Marquis de Lafayette, who as a rich young nobleman had defied his king and fought for America, returned to it, 67 years old, and penniless. Many of the spectators doubtless had in mind a gallant, boyish figure in the buff and blue of the American Revolution, with powdered hair tied in a queue, the historian wrote. What they saw was an old civilian in a short-haired brown wig. But when the old civilian stepped onto the Castle Garden landing stage, after a trip up the harbor on which his ship was escorted by a huge flotilla, to begin a visit on which he was to receive from the government and citizens of the United States gifts of bonds and land worth almost $500,000, the castle's cannon roared out 100 times. When the old man walked slowly into Battery Park to the incessant huzzas of the multitude that packed the waterfront, he walked between the weeping ranks of the Lafayette Guards. When he rode up Broadway, men and women on rooftops threw flowers in his path. A month later, a tall spar was raised in the center of the fort. A vast awning of sailcloth was spread across its entire ceiling. The white banner of France was entwined with the stars and stripes. Trophies of arms glittered from the walls. And when Lafayette appeared at the ball, the gay sets dissolved, and the dancers formed a long lane, and as the old man walked along it, he saw that each man and woman was wearing a medallion bearing his likeness, the women's entwined with roses. And it was at Castle Clinton that 10 years later, the handful of Lafayette Guards still alive drew up in a hollow square, in the center of which was a riderless black horse, spurred boots reversed, slung across its empty saddle, to hear the funeral oration for their dead hero. Lafayette was only one of 100 heroes for whom the old fort and Battery Park were the setting for the spectacles honoring them in triumph or in death. Troops were drawn up in the park by the thousands to greet Dewey after he defeated the Spaniards at Manila. The astrakhan busbies of cavalry hussars shook in the sea breeze. Pershing, after he defeated the Germans in France, and Teddy Roosevelt, after he returned from safari, conspicuous among the regiments out in full dress to greet the ex-president, were a handful of men in khaki and campaign hats, the Rough Riders. Most of New York's great triumphal processions began there. It was at the Battery that Wiley Post came ashore, and Admiral Byrd, and Gertrude Ederle, and Amelia Earhart, and Coste and Bayant, and, of course, Lindbergh, slim, bareheaded Lindbergh, to be greeted by Grover Whalen, and to ride in an open-air car between mounted policemen the short, glorious mile up a Broadway whose canyons were swirling with confetti. The fort's cannon boomed at solemn 1-minute intervals as the body of young Captain James Lawrence, who had earned immortality by crying, "Don't give up the ship," as he lay dying on the deck of the Chesapeake, was carried ashore, and as Washington's riderless horse, and Hamilton's and those of a score of other heroes of the Revolution, were led out from it up Broadway. In New York, in which the old was ruthlessly demolished to make way for the new, the fort was pricelessly rich in ghosts of the city's great past. In 1855, Castle Clinton was transformed into the landing station for the flood tide of immigrants from Europe. For 35 years, it would be the nation's gateway, the place at which almost 8 million human beings, in flight from persecution or poverty or famine in the old country, came ashore in the land of opportunity. Most important, though the old fort was, in 1939, well into the second century of its existence, part of the city's past, it was also, as the aquarium, part of the city's present, very much part. Its walls were filled with history, but they were also filled with life. Some idea of the popularity of the aquarium may be gleaned from its average annual attendance, 2,500,000. It was by far the most heavily attended public institution in New York. It was free, easily accessible to all the city, and with its giant turtles, spear-shaped, hideously spotted morays, grotesque toadfish, mammoth groupers, rainbow-hued tropical fish, and sleek, barking seals swimming in its gloomy depths, it had delighted generations of New York children. Sunshine, serenity, a sense of sea, a sense of history. build the bridge that Robert Moses wanted to build, and they would be accessible to the streets of Lower Manhattan no longer. Build the bridge, and the vista of New York Harbor would be destroyed, the majestic harbor sweep thrown into shadow, the sheer rising skyscraper mass slashed in half and blocked, one of the wonders of the world turned into mere, rather unimportant backdrop for just another East River bridge not very different from the three others just behind it. And plunk down in Battery Park a half dozen or more solid masses of concrete, each as big as an office building, and set on top of them, on top of the park, a roadbed 8 lanes wide, 2 lanes wider than the bridge, and there wouldn't really be a park anymore. What had been a place of sunlight and grass would become a place of concrete and steel and shadows. Instead of quiet, there would be, directly overhead, the roar of traffic. Instead of vistas of water, there would be only glimpses snatched between pillars. There wouldn't even be a sense of history. The old fort would be partially hidden by giant road piers. One would, under Moses' plan, be placed smack in front of it, and thoroughly dwarfed, no longer a monument bulking impressively at the end of a broad mall, filling the park with its presence, but a tiny ornament, cute but unimportant, cowering beside the immense pillar, lost in the shadow of the giant roadway above, its silence not majestic but meaningless among the noises of a new age thundering down from the big highway above. Build the bridge that Robert Moses wanted to build, and a prospect unexcelled by any city view in the world would become little more than an extension of the mean streets of Lower Manhattan. The park had once been an escape from those streets, the only escape. Now there would be no escape from them at all. Only someone thoroughly familiar with Lower Manhattan could appreciate fully what would be done to the area, and to the 500,000 people who spent their days in it, by the bridge that Robert Moses wanted to build. But New York's reformer aristocrats possessed that familiarity, and they determined to stop him from building it. Because they did, the fight over the Brooklyn Battery Crossing marked the end of Moses' long alliance with New York's good government movement, with the reformers in whose ranks he had, as a young man, once marched himself. The identity of the two men who led the opposition to the bridge spotlighted this aspect of the confrontation. George McCanany was one of the heroes of Moses' young manhood, the early crusader for civil service reform, who in 1909 had risked his hard-won business success. Not one of the wealthy reformers, he was a poor boy from Jersey City who had left school at the age of 15 to become a reporter on the Old World, to lend the weight of his reputation and that of the City Club of which he was president to a Bureau of Municipal Research expose, and thus persuaded Governor Charles Evans Hughes to oust corrupt Tammany officials. Borough president himself thereafter, a peppery, tart public official, he, rather than John Peroy Mitchell, could have had the Fusion mayoral nomination in 1917, but declined it because he felt Mitchell, as an incumbent, had a better chance of defeating Tammany. Lack of funds later forced him to retire from public office, but he never retired from public service. An early believer in city planning, he was the moving force behind the city's adoption of the first comprehensive zoning plan in the United States. Some indication of the respect in which he was held was his appointment in 1916 as executive manager of the New York Times. The title was meaningless, and during the 5 years he held the job, he never had a specific function. Times patriarch Adolf S. Oakes hired him, Oakes told friends, to act as a sort of moral background for the paper. He aged fast physically. In his 60s, he was strikingly wrinkled and shrunken. He had to hobble on a cane when he came to meetings. But he came. It was he who, in 1935, decided the city should have a World's Fair, and it was he who told Moses the location should be Flushing Meadows Park. Bob Moses was very amicable in those days. I said to him, "We have a great idea, and we want your help." Then I told him what it was, and he thumped the desk and said, "By God, that is a great idea." And in 1939, at the age of 70, McEnany was president of the Regional Plan Association and a key member of a dozen other organizations. Stanley Meyer Isaacs, a contemporary of Robert Moses, was born of the same stock, wealthy, Jewish, and dedicated to public service. What Moses' parents were to Madison House, Isaac's father, a pious Orthodox Jew, was to the Educational Alliance and the Citizens' Union. Like Robert Moses, Stanley Isaacs was a hiker, a mountain climber, and a brilliant student, top man in his class at Columbia. And, like Moses, he was a leader of men. "I can talk my head off to a room full of people, and when Stanley walks in, they melt away from me and surround him," a cousin said. In his youth, moreover, Isaacs apprenticed himself to the same principles to which Moses had apprenticed himself in his youth. As a young real estate lawyer, he spent evenings and weekends working for reform, doing legwork not only for his local Republican organization — he was elected district leader at 22, but for a succession of fusion tickets, as Moses had, in 1921, served as secretary of a fusion campaign committee. As Moses concentrated on a particular field, civil service, and made himself an expert in it, Isaacs concentrated in his youth on public housing and made himself an expert in it. And as Moses spent 4 years of his youth trying to accomplish something significant in his field, only to suffer bitter disappointment, Isaacs spent 4 years of his youth trying to accomplish something significant in his field with the same results. From 1925 to 1929, as chairman of the Housing Committee of the United Neighborhood Houses, he led the campaign for a law that would require slum landlords to provide their tenants with such amenities as windows and toilets. When, in 1929, his pleading finally embarrassed the legislature into passing a new multiple dwelling law, the statute was so watered down that it was virtually meaningless. But Stanley Isaacs remained true to his stock and his principles. His loyalty to friends and family was legendary. When his brother Julian was desperately ill with tuberculosis, Isaacs spent months in Saranac, cooking his meals and nursing him. Proud of being Jewish, he was active in Jewish philanthropies for 40 years. What social worker Helen M. Harris called his passion for social justice never burned low. Neither private nor political career ever prevented him from working for the causes of his youth. He served as president of United Neighborhood Houses for 25 years. By carrying a workload of mosaic proportions, "he has daily habits that would assassinate another man," a profiler wrote. He was active most of his life in 23 separate good government or charitable organizations. And he didn't abandon his fight for his first cause, as Moses had abandoned the fight for his. Stanley Isaacs would be a leader in the fight for better housing for more than 30 years after his 1929 defeat. And although the techniques of the reformer, free and open discussion, persuasion, education, had caused him only disappointment, and were, over and over, to cause him disappointment again, he never abandoned them for the techniques of the politician. Robert Moses may no longer have believed that the principle is the important thing, but Stanley Isaacs did. In 1937, after Isaacs had been working for the public for 30 years without ever holding public office, he was nominated, against his wishes, on the LaGuardia ticket for Manhattan Borough President, McEnany's old post. And when Isaacs was elected by more than 40,000 votes, after one quietly spellbinding campaign speech, LaGuardia, hugging him, exclaimed, "I don't know where you've been so long, Stanley." He demonstrated that neither position nor power would change his belief in what was important. He refused, to the point where his feelings became a family joke, to use his official limousine except on official business. He fired scores of political hacks and replaced them with a team of crack engineers. And he proved that there might occasionally be other ways of getting things done than Moses. It was Borough President Isaacs who built, without antagonizing the neighborhood, the East River Drive. Refusing to use his office for patronage himself, he refused to let anyone else use it for patronage either. he faithfully cleared his appointments with LaGuardia, but rejected the mayor's suggestions if they were based on political considerations. Declining to fill positions he did not consider necessary, he reduced the borough president's staff by 90 positions and his budget by more than 25%. To avoid embarrassing the other borough presidents, the Board of Estimate each year gave him more money than he asked for. At the end of each year, he returned the surplus. George McCannany was a man whom Robert Moses had once admired. Stanley Isaacs was the man whom Robert Moses had once been. Throughout Moses' career, McCannany and Isaacs had supported him, as had most of the other leaders of New York's good government movement. In 1919, when he had needed their money and the prestige of their great names to accomplish his reorganization of the state government. In 1924, when they gave him statewide power by electing him chairman of the State Council of Parks. In 1933, when, after their attempt to make him mayor had failed, they had helped persuade the man who did become mayor to bring him to power in the city. In 1935, when they had supported him against the president. In every great crisis of Robert Moses' 20-year-long public career, in the face of every threat to his plans or to his power, the reformers had given him their support. They had done so because they had believed that Moses, who had been one of them once, was one of them still, because they believed that his aims were still their aims, that the things he wanted to get done were still the things they wanted to get done. They thought of him, in fact, as their champion, as the young recruit who had risen from their ranks to become the one among them capable of leading to victory the causes for which they all marched. They had refused to listen to the handful among them who had tried to tell them what Moses was doing to the city. The American Scenic and Historic Preservation Society had, in fact, just awarded Moses its highest honor, the Society Gold Medal. But the Battle of the Battery Crossing, staged on terrain familiar and dear to them, was to give them a close look at Moses' values, and thus to show them that those values were no longer their values, that they were, in fact, utterly incompatible with the values they knew must be preserved in the city they loved. The Battle of the Battery Crossing was, moreover, to show them that the means Robert Moses employed were as incompatible with their principles as his ends. New York's reformers had never gotten a first-hand look at his methods. Before 1934, he had operated only outside the city. In the 5 years he had been operating inside, his projects had never directly affected more than a few of them at a time. When those few had tried to tell the others about their experiences, they had not generally been believed. Maybe, one of the reform leaders was to say, idolizing him like we did, we didn't want to believe. But they were going to have to believe now, for now Moses' methods were going to be used against them. Throughout his career, Moses had charmed people he needed, and then, as soon as he didn't need them any longer, had turned on them. He had always needed the reformers, because he had always relied on public support, and they were in many ways the key to that support. But now, thanks to his discovery of the possibilities of the public authority, he didn't need public support any longer, and therefore, he didn't need them. And now, when they decided to fight his bridge proposal, he turned on them. At first, not yet realizing with what they were dealing, believing that Moses had made an incorrect decision, but that he could be made to see that the decision was wrong and would therefore correct it, feeling, in other words, that he would be amenable to reason, they tried to reason with him, requesting meetings at which they could explain their objections. He did not even reply. The reformers were disturbed, but not yet worried. The government of their city was, after all, a government of laws, not of men, and there were ample laws to ensure against the construction of a public work on the whim of any one man, even if that man was supported by the mayor. There were laws, procedures, and public bodies established to ensure that the will of the public would determine whether a public work was to be built, and if it was, what its design would be. The will of the public might not be heard if the public most directly concerned was some local housewives group or chamber of commerce, they admitted, But they believed their will would always receive the fullest of hearings. They had at their command the technical expertise to examine Moses' proposal in detail and determine the facts for themselves, and they had influence enough to ensure that these facts would be published. The facts certainly deserved publication. According to Moses' attractively printed brochure, the Brooklyn Battery Crossing should be a bridge, primarily because a bridge, with all necessary approaches, would cost less than half as much as a tunnel, $41,200,000 compared to $84 million. Thus, the brochure stated, the bridge with necessary approaches can be financed by the sale of bonds to the public without the contribution of a nickel of city or federal money. And, according to the brochure, these figures were indisputable because the estimate for the bridge had been prepared by its designer, Othmar Ammann, the estimate for the tunnel by its designer, Ole Singstad. Singstad had found that last statement interesting. No estimate he had ever prepared showed the cost of the tunnel to be $84 million. His estimate, an estimate he had given to Moses when Moses asked for it, showed the cost to be $65 million. The reformers had found Moses' statement incredible. He said the bridge, including all necessary approaches, would cost $41,200,000. One approach alone, the elevated highway in Brooklyn, was, they knew, going to cost $12 million. Even without figuring in the cost of the Manhattan approaches, that left only $29 million for construction of the bridge proper. That figure was ridiculous on its face. The Bronx Whitestone Bridge, half as long and four lanes instead of six, had cost $39 million. Moses stated he had gotten the bridge estimates from Ammann, designer of the Bronx Whitestone. Knowing the famed Swiss engineer's reputation for integrity, the Citizens Union decided to find out if Moses' statement was accurate. Two representatives called on Ammann in his office. The engineer, normally so terse and positive, met their questions with finger-twisting silence. Finally, he told them that while, as one of them put it, he didn't want to be involved, he would give us some guidance. Guidance which enabled them to report to the Citizens Union Board of Directors that the $41,200,000 figure was not accurate at all. The board asked Paul Windels, a personal friend of Ammann's, to ask him if he would confirm the report. The report was confirmed. Moses' brochure had stated that the bridge and all necessary approaches could be built without a nickel of city money. Stanley Isaacs had read the brochure with care, and as a result, he was not worrying about a nickel of city money. He was worrying about 430 million nickels, $21,500,000. Isaacs had noticed that while the attractively drawn map in the attractively drawn brochure showed the indispensable connections between the bridge and the West Side Highway, whose southern terminus at the time was Duane Street, more than a mile away, and with the East River Drive, the cost of these connections was not included in the estimates. Walter Binger estimated the cost of the West Side extension at $11 million, that of the East River Drive at $7,500,000. Moses had stated that he would rebuild Battery Park after it had been torn up for the bridge approaches, but had not included the cost of the rebuilding in his estimates either. Binger said it would be $3 million. The reformers also realized that there were other costs involved, such as the $29 million loss in real estate taxes that Moses had never mentioned. The land in Battery Park on which Moses was planning to place anchorages and pillars didn't have to be paid for, of course, because the city already owned it, but its worth, in an area in which each square foot of land was worth hundreds of dollars, ran into the millions. On the basis of real cost, Singstad wrote, it is obvious that the bridge would be by far the more costly of the two projects, when all of the economic factors which should be included are considered. Add economic factors to the non-economic involved, the destruction of the park and the values it represented, the destruction of the once bustling Syrian quarter at the foot of Washington Street and the neighborhood values it represented, the destruction of the harbor vistas and the old fort, and there was a powerful case to be made for Singstad's tunnel and against Moses Bridge. The reformers did not say they were unalterably opposed to the bridge. Possibly a full-scale, impartial study of all the factors involved would prove that it was a better solution than the tunnel. But, they said, such a study should be made before a project of such magnitude was embarked upon, and such a study had obviously not yet been made by Moses or anyone else. The reformers' influence guaranteed that the city's officials and taxpayers would hear their side. In the crusty Singstad, they possessed an ally expert not only in engineering but in public relations, and he demonstrated that Moses had no monopoly on misleading drawings. Moses, to minimize the impact of the bridge, portrayed it from directly overhead. Singstad's, to dramatize that impact to the maximum, portrayed it from ground level, possibly, judging from some of the angles, from below ground, thus making the structure seem even higher than it was. There was something funny about the perspective, too. Moses wasn't sure exactly what it was. The best he could do was to rage that the drawings were completely phony. By the time the controversy came before the City Planning Commission, in the first step of the process through which the reformers believed the public will was to be expressed, they had the facts and figures and pictures ready to go. The day before the process began, however, the reformers' morning newspapers informed them that at Moses' request, bills had been introduced in Albany that would rescind the tunnel authority's authorization to build the Battery Crossing and transfer that authorization to the Triborough Bridge Authority. Such bills would, of course, be necessary if the city approved Moses' plans. But by introducing them before the approval had been given, Moses was acting as if it were a mere formality, as if the city had no choice but to give it. And, the reformers learned the next day, such was in fact the case. At the Planning Commission hearing, the reformers presented their painstakingly prepared facts and figures, maps and drawings. The Regional Plan Association said that if a tunnel proved too expensive, the alternative should not be a new bridge that would destroy the harbor and park, but a rebuilding of the three old East River bridges and the construction of a link between them, and between the Belt Parkway to the south and the Triborough Bridge to the north, along the lines of the future Brooklyn-Queens Expressway, a solution which the RPA pointed out would detour traffic around Manhattan instead of pouring more of it into its most congested area. The RPA had prepared preliminary plans and cost estimates for its proposal, but the commission did not make even a pretense of giving them serious study. 2 weeks later, by a 4-2 vote, it approved the Brooklyn Battery Bridge. The two dissenting commissioners said that the bridge would destroy values that the city would never be able to replace. The majority opinion did not disagree. The harbor would undoubtedly be altered by the bridge, it said. The park would undoubtedly be damaged. There are valid objections to a bridge. In fact, they too favored a tunnel. But the majority pointed out, the commission is not at this time called upon to choose between a tunnel and a bridge. No one was offering to finance a tunnel. Someone was offering to finance a bridge. A Brooklyn Battery crossing was urgently, desperately needed. If the only type of crossing available was a bridge it would have to be. One of the commissioners who voted for the bridge, Lawrence M. Orton, a former RPA member himself, would spell it out even more plainly to the author years later. The city didn't have the money for a crossing. Neither did the tunnel authority. Only one person had the money, Moses. And Moses wasn't giving us any choice. He just wouldn't build a tunnel. It was the bridge or nothing. Take it or leave it. We didn't have any choice. In Albany, meanwhile, Moses Bills, sponsored in the Assembly by Robert J. Cruz, brother of Triborough Insurance co-broker John R. Cruz, and backed by Assembly Minority Leader Erwin Steingut, Erwin considered Moses a practical fellow, and by the Republican leadership of both houses, were eating up the legislative track, ordinarily so slow, like thoroughbreds among a pack of percherons. Passed by the Assembly one afternoon, they were rushed that same afternoon to a Senate committee, and were released that same afternoon to the floor of the Senate for a vote. One upstate senator innocently requested time to consider the measures. He was handed a message asking him to take an urgent telephone call. When he returned to the floor, he dropped the request. But back in New York, Stanley Isaacs, studying the bills in his quiet way, noticed a point that everyone else had apparently overlooked. There was no home rule message from the city council attached to them, as the law required. And the arena in which the Battery Crossing fight was being staged was thereupon switched from the state capitol to the council chamber on the second floor of City Hall. In this arena, the reformers had hope of success. Three councilmen were, after all, reformers themselves, nominees of the Fusion Party. Five were members of the American Labor Party, and organized labor favored a tunnel because it would furnish 2,600,000 man-hours of work as against 600,000 for a bridge. And all 26 councilmen were susceptible to pressure from civil service organizations, angry as always at Moses because of his refusal to use civil service engineers on his authority jobs. He had recently stated it cost twice as much to do so. Who wanted the more compliant tunnel authority to build the crossing? Isaacs had, moreover, noticed in the bills a buried clause everyone else had overlooked, a clause specifically prohibiting Triborough from paying for the $11 million West Side Highway link. Surely, the reformers felt, now that this had been pointed out to the councilmen, they would not ask the legislature to approve the measures and thereby obligate the city, recently obligated to a $16 million expenditure it could not afford for one Moses project, to spend $11 million more. The reformers were also encouraged by the attitude of the mayor, whose reaction to Isaac's discovery of the buried clause was foot-stamping fury. Moses had won his support for the bridge by promising him in so many words that it would cost the city nothing. Knowing how Moses worked, the mayor was sure that the clause was not in the bills by accident, but was rather an attempt by Moses to sneak out of his promise and cost the city $11 million. A faint ray of hope was, moreover, beginning to appear on LaGuardia's horizon from the direction of Washington. Sentiment was building up in Congress for increased appropriations to the PWA. If the mayor could grab off a $30 million piece of that action for a tunnel, the Cooperative Tunnel Authority, instead of arrogant Triborough, could build the crossing. The mayor considered that if big. Sounding out Ickes, he was informed that $30 million more for New York was absolutely out of the question, but LaGuardia evidently felt that as long as there was any option at all, he should keep it open. He told key legislators privately that he had had second thoughts about authorizing Moses to build the crossing. He favored the bill authorizing Triborough to build a crossing, he said, but not the bill stripping such authorization from the tunnel authority, because he wanted both bridge and tunnel options kept alive. If PWA money came through, he could have the crossing built by the tunnel authority. If it did not, Triborough could build it. The reformers were also hopeful because their aim was modest. They were not, after all, insisting that the bridge proposal be defeated. They were only asking that it be studied. With three competing plans for a solution to Lower Manhattan's traffic problem, and wildly conflicting estimates of the cost and effects of each plan, surely an impartial study was needed to determine the true costs and effects before a decision was made. Moses was insisting on the need for haste, they said, but wasn't the need really for delay, a delay which would provide time for mature consideration? The decision the city took on the proposals would vitally affect it for decades, centuries perhaps. Was it not only rational to take a few more weeks or months to make sure the decision taken was the right one? Finally, the reformers were hopeful because they knew their own strength. United, they felt they could defeat any politician. In the last citywide election, in fact, their victory had been nearly total. Fusion had taken all three citywide offices— mayor, comptroller, and council president, as well as the presidencies of the two most populous boroughs in 1937. And never had they been more united. 4 years before, the leaders of New York's good government organizations had formed a central committee of civic organizations to support Robert Moses in his fight against Franklin Roosevelt's attempt to oust him from the Triborough chairmanship. Now, they formed another central committee, a central committee of organizations opposing the Battery Toll Bridge to oppose Moses. Within a week after its formation, its chairman, 83-year-old Albert S. Bard, had assigned speakers to address every civic-minded body in the city, and every organization concerned with the preservation of beauty and architectural excellence within it. Within a week, a score of such groups had joined the committee. Under the direction of Eric Gugler, a group of the city's most respected architects were visiting and enrolling other architects in the cause. Famous artists who had held aloof from the issue were contacted by artists of equal stature and persuaded that their participation was needed to preserve a beautiful and majestic scene. Bard was making sure that every reformer who had entree to a politician in City Hall, Albany, or Washington was using that entree. A sextet of septuagenarians, for example, spent a week in Washington explaining the situation to New York congressmen. And the most difficult of politicians, Fiorello Henry LaGuardia, Bard left to the most respected reformer of them all, the legendary Burlingham, Charles Culp Burlingham, 81 years old, almost deaf, but still the only man from whom LaGuardia would take a scolding. C.C. hobbled, gaunt and stooped, up the steps of City Hall one morning and was ushered in to see the mayor, as LaGuardia hastily shooed a group out of his office so that the old man would not have to wait a minute. Burlingham emerged to relay to intimates a promise from LaGuardia that while he would support a home rule message for the bill authorizing Triborough to build a crossing, he would not support or sign one for the bill stripping the tunnel authority of its authorization. The mayor told Burlingham that he would wait until the War Department, which had jurisdiction over all structures built in or across navigable waters, and which had scheduled a hearing on the bridge in April, had formally given approval to build it. The approval was only a formality, LaGuardia said, but at least it would give him an excuse to offer Moses for delaying. If, he promised, at any time until the War Department approval was received, money became available for a tunnel, he would see that it, rather than a bridge, was built. And the mayor promptly proved that he meant what he said by giving the tunnel authority permission to lobby in Albany against the bill, and by letting key legislators know that the lobbying had his sanction. The Central Committee did not neglect the public at large. Unlike the usual run of Moses' opponents, the prestigious reformers had entree both to letters to the editor columns and to editors, who usually heard in person only Moses' side of the controversy. Soon, even the Times was pointing out that a brief delay wouldn't hurt the plan. The bridge, if built, will be there a long time. It is worthwhile taking the time to get it right. The Herald Tribune demanded that Moses make public all the facts about the bridge, and, urging the council not to take action until he had done so, and until those facts had been studied, said, "It seems clear now that a major alteration in the city's design and appearance is involved. No conceivable need for hurry has been suggested. The need is therefore for the carefulest consideration and full public discussion, with every opportunity for alternatives to be reviewed impartially and thoroughly. No possible risk should be run of building in haste and repenting for generations to come." With the organized construction trades and the civil service organizations backing a tunnel, and with the letters to the editor showing support of the need for further discussion, it was clear that the tide of public opinion was running against Moses' proposal, to an extent it had never run against him before. Public opinion was the crucial factor in the reformers' philosophy and strategy. Public opinion was democratic government, the government they believed in. If it was not listened to, government was not democratic. A decent respect for public opinion had been a key ground for their demand that Roosevelt back down from his attempt to oust Moses. And they repeated that phrase in demanding that Moses back down now, and in insisting that, if he didn't back down voluntarily, the mayor and councilman make him. The reformers felt certain that the mayor and councilman would. They were, after all, politicians, and thus necessarily responsive to public opinion. But all the reformers' hopefulness proved was that they didn't understand how much power over politicians, Moses had been given, or how independent of public opinion he now was. Moses understood. So unconcerned was he about the reformers' efforts that he spent the 3 weeks before the council hearing vacationing in Key West, Florida. And the accuracy of his assessment of the situation was proven when, returning from a day fishing among the Keys, he caught two flounders, he received a telephone call informing him of LaGuardia's statement that he would delay signing a home rule message on the tunnel authority bill, even if the council passed one. Strolling down to the Key West Western Union office, he wrote out a telegram to the mayor, addressed to him at his apartment so that the mayor would receive it that same evening. No possible way of keeping both projects alive until after War Department hearing. Stop. Therefore, request you sign both messages. Stop. Otherwise, bridge project must be abandoned and Albany notified to this effect. If the mayor did not immediately guarantee that there would be no battery tunnel, Moses was saying, he, Moses, would never give him the money for a battery bridge. Either guarantee immediately that Moses could build the crossing and build the kind of crossing he wanted, or there wouldn't be any crossing. The telegram was not a request, but an ultimatum, not an appeal from a subordinate to a superior, not a plea from a commissioner appointed by the mayor that the mayor change a decision, but a demand from someone who had the money to give the mayor something he wanted. LaGuardia understood. After all his stalling, Moses' money was still the only money available. If he wanted the battery crossing, he would have to do what Moses wanted. The mayor had no more choice than the city planning commission had had. Summoning the council leaders to his office, he let them know that his feelings in the matter to be discussed at the upcoming hearing had changed. Robert Moses returned from Florida on the night before the council committee hearing. The Fine Arts Federation of New York, representing 18 leading art societies, had that day issued a statement warning that the bridge would disfigure perhaps the most thrillingly beautiful and world-renowned feature of this great city. A reporter asked Moses about the statement. "The same old tripe," he said. "We'll take care of it all tomorrow." Tomorrow was the city council chamber. City Hall filled a gap in the blank-eyed skyscraper wall with the dignity and grace and elegance of another age, and of all its rooms, its council chamber best evoked the values that the reformers had come to see were the real issues in the Battle of the Battery Crossing. Respect for the institutions and the law through which, in a democratic society, the will of the people found expression and realization. And that room evoked as well the manner that, in the age which had produced those institutions and laws, and many of those reformers, had been so much more important, the dignity, grace, and elegance in speech as well as appearance, the courtliness, the courtesy, the gentlemanliness. Before its mahogany panels, beneath its delicate wainscoting, the people's elected representatives deliberated under a delicately curving little gallery with an intricately detailed railing, at slanting-topped 18th-century desks arranged in a semicircle before a presidential dais flanked by flags of city and nation, under a ceiling, its details picked out in gold, featuring a huge mural of New York receiving the tribute of the nations. If the setting for the drama was apt, so was the casting. The audience that day was not the typical city council audience. In the memory of participants, there wasn't even a lone housewife present, not a single claque from a neighborhood civic association to bounce boos and hisses, cheers and the noise of foot stamping off the mahogany-paneled walls, and make Jefferson, observing bronze from the back wall, wonder if perhaps Hamilton had been right after all. Instead, sitting rank on rank in the gallery or on chairs set up to handle the overflow was the very flower of the city's civic leadership, men of wealth and talent devoted to the rule of law and the institutions of democracy that City Hall symbolized, men who had proven that devotion by spending their talent and their time in a dozen great civic battles. For the audience included not only young reformers, but elderly men whose first hero had been not LaGuardia, but Police Board President Theodore Roosevelt, the Burlinghams and Seaburys, Shieflands and McCananys, the men who had formed the heart of the Committee of 107 and the Committee of 1000, who had been fighting for generations against every threat to the institutions which they felt made their city great. There were starched wing collars in that audience, and vests crossed with heavy gold watch chains and pince-nez and walking sticks, and a spirit of reform that went back half a century and more. If New York had an aristocracy of civic leadership, it was assembled in the council chamber that day, when the long fleet of black limousines screeched up in front of City Hall, and the man whom they had once believed to be the living embodiment of their ideals, dressed in a double-breasted dark blue suit that only emphasized his burliness, and with a close-clipped haircut that emphasized the massiveness of his face and his bull neck, impatiently flung open the door of the first of the limousines without waiting for the chauffeur to come around, and, with a full score of aides half running behind him to keep up, stalked into City Hall, pounded up the delicate curve of the hanging staircase, strode past the slender fluted columns on the rotunda, and burst through the chamber door. The opening presentation by Moses Architects and Engineers took 2 hours, but, to the reformers' surprise, provided none of the facts for which they had been asking. Amar Embury described the bridge with the help of a large-scale model, the same large-scale model Embury had already privately all but admitted to the reformers was misleading. Othmar Ammann, noticeably ill at ease, repeated that the bridge would cost $41,200,000 and the tunnel $84 million, but again did not break down the figures, so that the reformers could not determine on what, if anything, they were based. Although, with Ole Singstad present, Ammann did not this time attempt to maintain that some of the figures came from Singstad. Moses' opponents provided facts, in abundance. Stanley Isaacs, directing the opposition presentation, told the councilman, who goggled over this unprecedented passing up of a chance for personal publicity, didn't he realize that it was only 1 o'clock, the perfect time for a speech to make the late editions of the PMs? That he would not speak himself, but would simply introduce a series of experts who would prove, through specific facts and figures, that, on almost every point of the bridge-tunnel controversy, a tunnel would provide greater benefits and cause less harm to the city. Major Henry J. Amy, executive director of the Citizens Budget Commission, analyzed Moses' contention that the bridge and its approaches wouldn't cost the city a nickel, and then simply read the clause of Moses' proposed state legislation that would cost the city $11 million. A battery of municipal finance and real estate experts documented, block by block, building by building, Singstad's conclusion that a bridge would cost the city at least $1,500,000 per year in real estate taxes. Regional Plan Association experts testified that everything Moses hoped to achieve by building a new bridge could be achieved at a small fraction of the construction cost and real estate tax loss by their alternate plan. Isaacs had even commissioned an analysis of Moses' argument, never before analyzed during the decade Moses had been making it, that civil service architects and engineers were less efficient and therefore cost twice as much as the private consultants he employed. The analysis documented that one group did cost twice as much as the other, Moses' group. Even Moses' claim that a bridge would have twice the capacity of a tunnel was disproven by Triborough's own traffic counts for its 2 suspension bridges, which showed that inclement weather and inclemency for a Brooklyn Battery Bridge would include not only rain, snow, ice, and high winds, but the fog, which is frequently heavy over the lower bay, while not affecting a tunnel's capacity, significantly reduced that of a bridge. As to the relative cost of the 2 types of crossing, Isaac's experts gave the detailed breakdowns Moses had not, proving Singstad's claim that a tunnel would cost $65 million, and disproving all Moses' claims. Moses had said that the total cost of the bridge, including approach roads, would be $41,200,000. RPA engineers found that the cost of the bridge proper, without approach roads, would be $56,625,000. Isaacs had insisted that all the figures used be conservative, but even conservative figures were devastating. When Isaacs' parade of witnesses, a parade that lasted for more than 4